last speaker in this first panel is Professor Barry Allen Shane, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at Colgate University. I am pleased to see that while he got his undergraduate degrees at San Francisco State and San Jose State, he managed to improve his education by getting his master's of philosophy and his PhD at Yale University. He has such a long resume that there's no way I'm going to occupy his 15 minutes reciting everything he's written and done. But I would certainly like, I'd be remiss if I did not mention some of his awards and honors. For example, during the years 2000-2001, he was the IFC Panhellenic Faculty Lifetime Achievement Award winner. He was director of the John M. Olin Foundation Lecture Series, The Nature of Rights at the Founding at Colgate. In 2000, he won the Colgate University Faculty Award in Political Science. Between 1997 and 2000, he was an Earhart Foundation Research Fellow. Earlier, he was the John M. Olin Foundation Fellow in History, the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow. He was a Richard M. Weaver Fellow, and of course, a Yale University Prize Teaching Fellow, which I think is perhaps the best of them all. I happen to be an Eli, in case you didn't know that. And he never would have guessed it. Well, he's done so many things and written so many things that I don't know exactly where to begin, except it's 8 pages worth, so I'm not going to try. Without further ado, I will introduce Professor Shane.
The problem of emails from Europe. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really very thankful for Bill for having invited me. In part, I sometimes find, in some ways, in the same way that Gary was describing, is that some of our conversations are a bit too closed, and it's nice to have an opportunity to offer a perspective that may or may not be congenial to all. My talk is going to be titled Self-Interest versus Virtue, Conservatism, and America's Divided Inheritance. Bill asked me, I sent him 3 papers, and he said, well, I'm interested in all 3. Can you condense the 3 papers, each which are about 50 pages, into 15 minutes? I'm going to try. But in Maine, just to give you some landmarks, my goals are to offer you a set of choices. What I'm going to suggest is America has an inheritance, like most nations, which is in fact multivalent. That in fact, conservatives often are, I think, wrong in thinking that their traditionalism, traditionalism is self-sufficient, that somehow you don't need decision rules as to allow you to decide between traditions. America has more than one tradition, but I'm going to suggest only one is in fact authentically conservative and should be one that you should celebrate and defend. I'm going to suggest that the two traditions today are defended by different populations. And in large measure, the one that I'm going to criticize and ask you at least to look at maybe more critically than you have in the past is generally defended by neoconservatives. Neoconservatives either of the secular variety or of the kind we associate with Robbie George, of a sort of neo-Thomist variety. But in both instances, I think they've guided us or are guiding us in a direction which I think is in fact wrong. Wrong for America and wrong for conservatives. So what I want to do is paint a picture of two traditions of thought, two traditions of Republican government, one which I'm going to recommend as authentically American and one most congenial to conservatives, and the other which I'm going to suggest is in fact a liberal tradition, one that should be antithetical to conservatives and is contemporarily defended by the same folks that have a foreign policy which I associate with Napoleon, which I also hold us to be, we should be somewhat skeptical about. Once again, two traditions in America. One, a tradition that goes back to the foundings in 1607 of the various plantations. A tradition that would be largely embodied and given its probably most articulate defense in the Revolution, or I should say the War of Independence against Britain. In this tradition, Americans are viewed as a particular people, a people of particular competence in terms of their ability to live a virtuous life. Communities are constructed in part to support that capacity. Along with their particular qualities that allow virtue to be a goal, it also is tied to democratic self-government. So one tradition of republican government, one I associate with the particular nature of American conservatism, is a tradition which holds individuals capable of a virtuous life largely through democratic local self-government. The other tradition arose very late in the American tradition, at least if you go back to 1607 as an origin. It develops in the 1760s and 1770s. No, let me take it back. Not the 1760s, only in the 1770s and 1780s. It's a tradition of disappointment. It's a tradition which American elite, largely we've called an elite today, came to the conclusion that in fact Americans were not the people that they thought they had been. They were not capable of virtue. Maybe in fact no people ever had been, as they began to embrace a very modern tradition of thought. But if other people may have been or not, they came to the conclusion that Americans were not a particularly virtuous people. And not only were they not particularly virtuous, they weren't really capable of self-government. What this tradition held, largely articulated by a particularly precocious ideologue, James Madison, is they held that that Americans were not capable of virtue. Instead, government should be founded on self-interest. But in addition, not only self-interest, most people, I think, at least those who read with some care The Federalist, are cognizant of at least that argument being put forward. But what's often overlooked is that he also did away with, or hoped to do away with, democratic self-government of a kind that was traditionally American, or at least of a kind that Americans had aspired to hold on to. What James Madison wanted to do was to return America to 1760. What he was a defender was British imperial government. In fact, of a kind that the British weren't able to put in place, in fact, of a kind that had led to the American break with Britain. What he wanted to do was to find a means to allow a centralized elite to overturn state and local laws of those who are moral majorities. Those are the people that worried him, those are the ones that concerned him, and his aspirations were to undermine and basically to undo the American Revolution. That's the ultimate tradition that you have to confront. The two traditions that I'm asking you to think about, one is that of the American Revolution and that of our Reformed Protestant forefathers, of virtue, or at least the aspiration after virtue, and local democratic self-government. And the other one, largely articulated and developed by a group of disappointed elites in the 1770s, most articulately defended and advanced by Madison, which holds that virtue is not something we should aspire to, but self-interest should be the controlling mechanism of government. And, moreover, is that democratic self-government, local self-government, is really not in keeping, again, with the American spirit. We'd overreached. What we needed to do was return to the British imperial form of government, where local and state laws could be overturned by a centralized elite. Of course, Madison's aspirations wouldn't be fulfilled, at least not in the 17th or 18th or 19th centuries. Madison's vision, those of you who are most greatest admirers of Madison, I think probably have not thought about it thoroughly enough. Madison's vision is only embodied and only fulfilled in the Warren Court of the 1960s. That's James Madison's vision. The Warren Court, a small group of self-arrogating elite that overturn state laws and prevent the moral dissemination of a vision in American local government. He wanted it in 1780. He didn't get it until long after he was buried in the Warren Court. And what that is the question or the challenge you have to confront. What makes this difficult is that conservatives often have a sense of wanting it both ways. They want it hold to a set of values, and they want to admire or at least celebrate the founders. What I'm suggesting to you is you don't have that choice, or if you do, you can't be honest and you can't be coherent in making that choice. You have to choose a difficult choice. You can choose to celebrate and defend a set of values, or you can celebrate a certain group of individuals whose lives, and at least thinking often, was committed to the destruction of those values. So the choices, I think, are difficult because we want it both ways. Madison, I think, offers us his understanding of what government should be most clearly in the writings around the Federalist. Not just in the Federalist, but around the Federalist. Federalist number 10, probably his most famous essay, is in fact a rump essay. It only contains part of his argument because he's not a man who's indifferent to political concerns. He couldn't write fully or develop fully his argument in Federalist 10. Most of you teach, or many of you teach, Federalist 10 as if somehow it's an insightful essay. Most of you also probably don't know that Madison was a precocious and very progressive mind of a kind that was rarely understood by his colleagues. What did he want? Again, Federalist 10 was an attempt to try to protect minorities and individuals from majorities. How was that to be done? He argued largely through extending the size of the republic. But what's often overlooked is that the extended republic argument cannot work. It will not work as long as moral police powers are not something generally open or subject to federal jurisdiction. The only way for the argument in Federalist 10 to come to be effective is either through one or two mechanisms, either through federal oversight at the legislative or executive level, or at a judicial level. Madison wanted federal oversight at the executive or legislative level. This is what he fought for throughout the Philadelphia Convention. And when you read the Ferrand's notes, Madison doesn't come off as the father of the Constitution. He comes off as remarkably obstinate ideologue who's committed to a set of values which, no matter to the very end of the convention, he wouldn't surrender. What did he want so desperately? Some mechanism to ensure that local self-government would not have the capacity to create moral visions and inculcate it in their residents. He wanted to ensure that the exact same mechanism that the Privy Council to overturn state and local laws would be awarded to the new centralized administration. He didn't get it. He didn't get it later in First Congress when he attempted, under Jefferson's persuasion, to move from from legislative and executive control to judicial control. He didn't get it then. Once again, he only would get it with the incorporation doctrine of 1925, beginning under Gitlow versus New York, which overturned 1833 Baird versus Baltimore. Only in the 20th century would Madison's vision of federal oversight, or I should say national oversight, come to fruition. I'd like to also say that not only is this the case that Madison's vision is the one that we should think about very carefully as one that is antithetical to our own, but I'd also like to confront those who argue that, in fact, Madison didn't take this position, that Madison, in truth, wasn't a defender of self-interest, that if you read the Federalist and other essays and speeches he made in the late 1780s, one finds mention of virtue. I think too often most people read the Federalist and his speeches in a very selective manner. Now, one could accuse me of doing the same, of picking and choosing. And I think that's a fair criticism, and it's one where we need to confront each other. Is that Madison wrote in ways which are ambiguous, or one might, if one was less generous, say contradictory? I think that's not surprising. Madison was a man who was political. He had at least two audiences. Again, going back to these two standards of Republican government, one audience, an elite group, which was become disappointed, found that the arguments about virtue very uncompelling. In fact, they were, if not secret Humeans, some of them were secret Mandevillians, as at least the Anti-Federalists recognized. He spoke to them in a language that they understood, which was that of self-interest. virtue was not a foundation upon which government could rest for these men. They become despondent. They become no longer believers in what America had believed in for 100 years, and most clearly during the Revolution. But he also had to persuade, or at least thought he had to persuade, those who were anti-federalists. And the anti-federalists are very clear in the New York debates and in New York, is that they understood what was going on. Modern thought had, in fact, understood virtue to be a silly aspiration and one that one could not trust. They wrote in opposition to the Federalists and the Federalists as men who were guided by Mandeville or Hume, and that this ridiculing of virtue was something they found to be unacceptable. They'd grown up under Montesquieu, understanding that, in fact, Republican governments rest on virtue. What kind of governments rest on self-interest? What kind of governments rest on the manipulation of passions? They knew that too. They were monarchies. Under the understanding broadly prevalent in the 18th century, self-interested and its emotional or passionate control was a control used by monarchies. Republican governments did not use that means. So Madison had to, one would assume he'd have to respond to this criticism. In part, he did so by lines that we now take as somehow dispositive of his broader philosophy. I think that's mistaken. In the Federalist Essays, Madison does provide his guidance as to how to discriminate between these two visions and which he thought was, in fact, the essential one. He tells us that government had to cure two problems, and in particular, popular government had to cure two problems. What were the two problems? The first problem was how to control the people, how to prevent people from acting in factious manners where majorities could in some ways overawe and impose themselves on minorities or individuals. The other basic problem was of controlling government itself. How do you control government? You want to prevent one branch from usurping power from the other. In both instances, and he very clearly, four times, tells us these are the basic problems of popular government. Now, when you turn to him to ask, how is it that he wants to solve each of these two essential problems, at no time does he turn to resources we would associate with virtue. As for the first problem, that of preventing groups from usurping or acting in factious ways towards minorities, his aspiration was to use the extended republic and filtration through representation in the legislature. Neither aspect depended on popular virtue. One for the moment might think that it depended upon virtue in the representative assembly, but at least at the popular level, there was no aspiration. All that was assumed to the people was that they would be greedy. They would actually serve their interests. So in that first level, virtue had no role to play, and again, as I pointed out earlier, Federalist 10 is a rump essay. It leaves out the central element of controlling, of means of control to prevent moral police powers being exercised at the local level. That only could be done by a federal judiciary or federal executive which could overturn state laws. Again, that wouldn't find an embodiment in the United States until basically the Warren Court in the 1960s. The second problem is, in fact, one that he also turns away from virtue and turns to a novel concept. The second problem, which is how to control government, in fact, Madison wrote in a very, very, I think, almost brilliant fashion. The two traditional remedies for controlling governments so that they would not overturn or act in usurping fashion against other branches was either to have institutional mechanisms that would allow for varying estates to stand against other estates. That was the most traditional mechanism that generally associated with monarchies. The other tradition was to inculcate virtue such that those who would govern would be guided by some internal compass. The first traditional solution Madison described as one that had no applicability in the United States. Why? There were no established estates. He didn't have the requisite resources that could work and had worked in England and elsewhere. As for the second traditional solution, the inculcation of virtue, Madison just thought it never worked. In any event, it would not work in America. They weren't the right material. If there ever did any people the right material, he was dubious. So he had to come up with an alternate solution to prevent the usurpation by one branch of another. And here he acted in the most, I think, clever, original way. He believed that the American institutional arrangements that he was defending, that we now call the Constitution, would provide mechanisms such that each individual's selfish interest would be tied to the particular formal structure of the governmental branch within which they found themselves. It would be ego. It would be the desire for honor, the desire for a proud sense of themselves, a kind of vanity that would be the mechanism, the motor, to ensure that one branch of government wouldn't be usurped from another. If one thinks about it, if there were one branch that was embodied by or held by those who were selfless in a traditional virtuous sense, the system would in fact collapse, because they wouldn't be able then to resist the intrusion of another branch who was led by the normal arrogance which he assumed of men. So Madison proposed a solution for controlling the two basic problems of government, neither which rested on virtue, both which rested on self-interest, though of a different order. For the people, he anticipated only avarice and greed to be the controlling force. The proper institutional arrangements would ensure that greed against greed would prevent, or at least he hoped, would prevent the usurpation or the exploitation of individuals and minorities. He didn't trust that fully. He thought, again, that you needed to have a centralized elite that would be able to basically vacate laws. As for between governments, his solution was honor, was creating mechanisms that would encourage the development of a sense of pride of place such that one would resist the intrusion of another branch. So the two essential problems that Madison believed government confronted, he offered solutions creative and innovative in each instance, but neither which rested on rested on virtue, both resting on self-interest. So what we have is, as I suggested earlier, we have two basic alternatives before us. We have a tradition that is as old as any of the first plantations in America, which rests on a concept that the good life is lived through a local life in which local communities take responsibility for the individuals within that community to help to encourage a life of virtue. It depends on a self-governing localism that's majoritarian. I think this is the most traditional, the most authentic, and the most conservative of the two options that you confront. The other option you confront, which is generally proposed or at least advanced by neoconservatives today, is one that I think rightly associate with Madison. It's a vision that's developed by a group of disgruntled elites who have lost confidence in the capacity of local communities to inculcate virtue. No, I should even go further. They not only have lost confidence in that, they wanted to do everything in their power to prevent local communities from inculcating virtue because they didn't trust them. They were quite confident that they would inculcate virtues of a kind they would be uncomfortable with, most likely Christian. They found themselves trying to undermine and in some ways to weaken the capacity of local Christian communities to be self-creating and self-perpetuating. The aspirations of Madison, particularly that of being able to vacate state and local laws, was most definitely concerned with the capacity of federal or national elites to vacate state laws of a moral character. Those who believe that Madison and Publius more generally had held the position that the national government should not be in the moral business, but the local should, I think read Madison wrongly. He was far more ambitious than that. He wanted to use the national to ensure that there would be no inculcation of moral virtues of a kind that one would traditionally associate with America. He had an aggressive liberalism. That's the other vision that we can embrace, but I can't see why a conservative would wish to embrace a vision that was best embodied or best developed in the Warren Court, and in fact is a liberal vision which wants to use centralized elites to protect individuals against moral majorities. I think you have a clear choice then. You can embrace the vision of the revolution. You can embrace the vision of our Calvinist forefathers, or you can embrace the vision of James Madison, which attempted to overturn the Revolution and put back in place a body of institutional arrangements which are best associated with the monarchical imperial aspirations of the British government in the 1760s, one in which centralized elites imposed their will on local majorities. Those are the two choices I think you have to confront. For me, I don't think there's actually much of a choice. The choice should be that of our longest lived, most authentic tradition, that of local communities aspiring after a life of virtue led through local self-government. Thanks.